The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our best ever Wi-Fi all around your home, your world is limitless.
Okay, welcome back at bang on 9:30. Perfect. We welcome Patrick Frayne, journalist and author, to the programme. Patrick, nice to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Nice to see you.
We've crossed paths a few times, always professionally, because you've written a few articles in and around. But that's okay.
That's okay.
We're still talking, which is good news.
Yes.
There was never any badness in it, which is nice. But this is not. This is a totally different ballgame now. You've decided to mine, if you like, your own story,
yeah,
and produce this series of eminently entertaining essays. I suppose the first question has to be why.
So I'm not entirely sure why, which isn't the best answer. But I know that for a long time, when I write for the Irish Times, I've been writing either writing about other people, or I've been writing my column on a Friday, which is about telly, and I usually kind of have a bit of fun with that. But I've never really gone into writing about my life or writing about my opinions or things like that. So when I kind of read, I've always thought I'd like to write a funny book. So I always loved stuff like Clive James and David Sedaris and PJ O'Rourke. But over the last few years, I was kind of blown away by some of the writing by people like Emily Pine and Sinead Gleeson. And that kind of infiltrated as I started going, okay, I could write about this funny time I did this thing with my band. As soon as I started writing, other memories would come back.
Yes.
And the funny memories would kind of give way to a kind of more serious, thoughtful thing. And it just, it kind of accumulated. And Brendan Barrington, my editor, was very good at allowing it kind of accumulate. He'd just kind of go, do you have any more essays? And I'd go, yeah, I don't know if I do. And then I'd go, there was that time I did that parachute jump, and I'd go away and I'd start writing.
So,
and
all these yarns started kind of going, oh yeah, there was, and it became a thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's more to it. It's not just that you're telling the story of what happened. You're giving us a lot of yourself in terms of the psychology of it, or the effect it would have had on you as a person as well. So it's not just that this happened and it was gas.
No, like I think I'm a thoughtful enough person anyway, right? And as soon as you start remembering these things, you start remembering the feelings you had,
yeah,
and you start thinking about how you've changed. And that's like the fascinating thing to me is, like, I think in one of those stories, I actually go, if this was a short story, I'd have to go workshop it, because I have no idea what the motivation of the main character is. And the main character is me.
Yeah,
and I look,
yeah,
back and I go, I have no idea what I was thinking there.
Yeah.
You know, when you do things that are out of character. And I started thinking kind of quite, I suppose, more charitably and fondly on some of the things. Like, yeah, I was in bands for years, and I wrote a bit about that in the book. And the guys I was in the band with, we were really close. And I wrote a lot about the kind of shenanigans.
Mm-hmm.
But as you're writing about those things, you do start thinking a lot about what it meant and what it meant to be in a band, which I now think is like a stage of development,
yes,
for a young person.
Yeah.
I think everyone should be in a band.
But it's funny, your reflections later on about the band is kind of centre around how you were a very different human being, almost like somebody else's story entirely. You call it a hive, I think, that you can't infiltrate anymore.
Yeah, like bands are amazing. I actually think, have you ever been in a band?
Look at me, Patrick.
You should start a
band
now.
You're sitting here in front of me. Yeah. Tummy Tub Tubs and the Nerds. The brand new.
That's a great name.
Thank you very much. Just like, came up with it now.
So being in a band, any young people listening or old people, there's something amazing about when you have to collaborate and compromise creatively with people you're close to. And it's kind of like,
yeah, that's like putting a radio program together.
Like putting a radio program together. That is your band. And I'm sure there's these kind of beautiful moments of connection and disagreement. Some of those disagreements, which feel really heated at the time, when you look back, are actually kind of wonderful things.
Yeah.
You know, that something great, fun came out of, you know, that you cared so much is wonderful.
But you loved your time in the bands. I mean,
I did. Like at the end, like it's always difficult. It's like, bands are like practice marriages or something. So you're married to these two or three other guys as you go around. So it's amazing. And like, there was hard times too. And we were, you know, there's times when you feel like you're failing.
Yes.
You know, like in a lot of ways, I'm a failed musician, but I would never regret any of the stuff.
No. And you're right about it beautifully. But I'm going to go back to, I don't know, it was kind of in 2 miles whether when I came in this morning, I said to the lads, I loved this. I put the book down and I said, you know, it's kind of like a funky Michael Harding.
Funky Michael, that's kind of cool.
And that's no offense to, I love Michael's books and I read them because they're just something about them that's kind of like a salve. And I found this book was exactly like that, except that it was more in tune to my generation a bit, because yeah. I'm a bit younger, a little bit. And pretty much the same age as me, so I think I was able to connect a tiny bit more. But that's not to take away from Michael's, but it's also meant as a great compliment to yours, because it just felt very easy reading. I would like to bounce along some of the bits that really struck me, if you don't mind. One was when you were young, you came from an army background, which I didn't realise. Your dad... strikes me as being an intriguing, and your mum, by the way, you cut to the chase, you kick off, you're on a camping trip. I said, where is this going? And out you go to the hills of wherever it is with your dad, and you think you're going on a camping trip.
Yeah, so we had this great conversation a few years ago. Myself and my wife were visiting home, and I said, Dad, do you remember that camping trip we went on? It was like this bonding experience when I was around 12.
Yeah,
and Dad goes, oh yeah, right. There was rumours of an IRA training camp in the Wicklow Mountains.
Yeah.
So I was sent down. My dad was in the Rangers. So we were kind of tasked with seeing if there was any truth in that. And I thought that if I brought you, we'd look like a father and son on a camping trip.
That's great.
I was like, I thought we were a father and son on a camping trip. And he goes, no. Well, we were. But, you know, I thought, you know, if people spotted us, because I'd remembered weird things, like we had a walkie-talkie. And every now and again, Dad would tell me to read coordinates in the walkie-talkie. And I thought this was just fun.
Yeah.
But it was to other army men that were in the mountains. My dad goes, it was perfectly safe. And I go, how was it safe? He goes, it was fine. I had a gun.
Yeah.
And I'm like, so these are, like, it's fascinating to me. Because my dad is like a very nurturing, kind man. Like, he's actually quite maternal. Like, he kind of cooks and cleans and he did all those things. But he had this, he was also this kind of tough guy, very unlike me and my brother, who are kind of fey, arty guys.
We should say that, because you're the typical bearded, long-haired, former muso hack. Your dad is it sounds like a crew cut, shoulders up, great deportment.
If he walked in here, you'd instantly go, he's in the army.
And you'd nearly stand up, would you?
You would stand up. You'd probably try and salute.
But it's so funny, because you say this, you were telling your wife about the gun. You said, what type of gun, she asked. And you said, you asked my wife, whose hippie parents wouldn't let her play with toy guns and who will certainly, as a consequence, end up killing someone with a gun. The more you tell people not to do something...
Yeah.
As kids, you know the way I always think, if you over demonize something like sweets or whatever it might be, all they want to do is eat sweets.
I got to shoot a machine gun when I was very young, which Dad probably wasn't allowed. But he brought me and my cousin to the ranges and let us have a go. And like, I really wanted to be in the army for ages, because we lived in the Curra camp and it looked cool, and I loved war films and I loved war comics, and I was kind of like slightly obsessed with. I think I say in the book as well, I used to have these arguments with the parish priest who used to come to the school asking when it was okay to kill someone.
Yeah. You go through the poor priest. I actually came out on the priest side, because you kept putting it.
I was going, what if there was a terrorist in a cable car and he had his finger on the bomb that was going to kill the hostages? Could you shoot him then? And the priest would be like, the poor priest was going, I suppose you could, but you'd have to go to confession. And you'd have these. So I really wanted to be in the army for ages. And it was only in my kind of, it slowly was dawning me in my teens that my personality wasn't really suited to that. I think I liked the arts because there was no clear winner and you could always kind of cheat.
Well, actually, before I move on to the arts and sport, which I really want to talk to, there was another passage I loved. Tell everyone why there was a point at which you called your mother Carmela.
All right. That was because of taking us up to them, letting my dad take me up to the mountains. My mother was always going, like, my mother is a very intelligent feminist woman, but she often goes in retrospect, I don't remember that. And we're like, how can you not remember that? Like, there's this convenient parents, my generation's parents, they have a very convenient memory lapse.
It's selective.
Selective.
But she's called Carmela, obviously, because of...
So Carmela Soprano. It's
Carmela Soprano.
Because if my dad's vaguely criminal enterprises ever failed, she would slip into the lead role. Yeah.
You write about, Patrick, you write about sport. And you said, when I was 9, I began to pretend that I liked sport. And you did that to fit in. And 10 seconds into a sports game now, I can, and I mean all of the sports games, I'm reading from your book, obviously, I find my eyelids drooping and the colours on the screen blending into one another. It's like I have a sports-specific learning difficulty. However, as a child, I also had the instincts of a rural politician, and I knew that not liking sports would be no good for my social standing as I moved from school to school. It's very brave for an Irishman to admit not having any interest in sport whatsoever.
Because it feels so weird. Like, as I was growing up, it felt like my brother's the same, and we both talk about this. Like, as you're growing up, you kind of have to fake it a bit, because being into sport is like, it's the language of mankind, of men. Like, as soon as you meet a strange man, and you have to have a conversation, Taffy, they'll start going, yeah, did you see the match? Yeah. And I'll instantly go, what match? Or what sport? Like, I won't know what sport they're talking about. And sometimes I'll look around and go, oh, there was loads of people with jerseys around the city at the weekend. But I just thought that was a fashion choice. It had just gone completely over my head. And I kind of do find that, like, I love the idea now, and I think there is more acceptance of the idea for kids that you can just be into your thing.
Absolutely.
Like, even the fact, like, nerdiness basically just means you're really interested in something which is cool, and you're passionate about something that not everyone is into,
yeah,
which is kind of the opposite of sport, because everyone feels like they're into sport. I guess it's not the opposite of being into, like, a niche sport like lacrosse or, yes, something. I think you could call a lacrosse sports fan nerdy.
Or Quidditch.
Or Quidditch.
Like, you really go for it.
Is there actually... Oh, there is. People started doing Quidditch?
Oh, they have. Yeah, they have. It's a whole thing. It's a whole thing. Let's talk briefly. I'm sorry for bouncing around, but your book does bounce, and that's what makes it so attractive, especially for an adult mind like mine. I was like, yes, great, great. He's going somewhere completely different.
I'm hoping it's good for COVID times.
Oh, it is. Do you know what? It's very COVID friendly, because it was a beautiful distraction from it all. I really mean that. It's really perfect for that, among other things. You described the Gaeltacht as essentially a teenage...
Can I say? Yeah. A sex camp.
A teenage sex camp. And I think you're probably trying to describe it to people who don't, who've never heard of the Gaeltacht. But why do you describe it so?
Because it's so funny kind of thinking back at things I've actually put in the book. And yeah. I have
them all here, Mark. Okay, keep going. There's more to come.
Because it's kind of where loads of people go and have their first kisses.
Yeah.
And you go, and it occurred to me that part of it is you're deprived of, if you're not, and like, if Irish isn't your first language, you're kind of deprived of your main form of communication, and you're stuck for things to say, so you kiss each other. So I write, there's a chapter in the book which that's from, which is basically a litany of things that when I first remembered them really embarrassed me.
Yeah.
And now I find really funny. And actually the fun thing about, you were asking about why I wrote it, like, the fun thing about remembering some of that stuff is by putting it into a funny narrative,
yeah,
you get to kind of pull some of the embarrassment out of it.
You having met you a couple of times, you strike me as being kind of not introverted, but lower key than, say, a show off like myself on the face of it. And yet you write quite stridently about being a show off. You say you are, but you it's almost like you're a passive aggressive show off. Like,
exactly.
Do you know what I mean? What is that?
I don't know. Like, I realize that, like, even having the book out is strange for me, and it's like, pretending I'm not a show off when you have a book that's basically about yourself falls flat. My wife has a word for it, or a phrase for it. When we were planning to get married, I was kind of nervous about having a big ceremony, and I said, I prefer to dance out of the shadows. And I realized that's what I do, and it's awful.
What
I
does
like,
it mean? It means
if you give me an opportunity where no one is expecting me to do something cool, like sing a song or tell a funny story, that's when I'll do it.
Okay.
Whereas if you shine the spotlight on me, I'll go, not now.
So you're a sniper show off.
I'm a sniper show off.
You're not going in all guns. You'll just every now and again go, here's a great tune, sung in tune.
Yeah.
Just when you're least expecting it.
Oh, who's singing? Oh, it's Patrick. Well, that's quite good.
I wasn't expecting that.
That's exactly.
And your tummy feels tickled then, like a cat.
Yeah, I'm not... Like, for a long time, I was kind of pretending to be a shy person, but I'm not. I'm like, and I'm, these are some of these things are shameful admissions in the book.
Yeah.
And now I can't, like, actually, one of the interesting things psychologically about writing some of this stuff is putting it down on paper slightly rewires you.
Yeah.
So like some of my thinking has already changed purely because I put things down. I don't think I can be an undercover show off anymore.
That's gone. Here you are with your book telling us all that, you know, for those people who didn't get to see you perform as a front man of a band going, yeah, well, you can't really be that introverted as much as you'd like to portray yourself as. It's quite confusing.
There's a lot of levels.
Like Inception.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about, you get into serious territory about anxiety, I suppose. You describe yourself as being overwhelmed by choices. You write, I become an anxious wreck, a boiling stew of self-loathing, an endless series of fruitless, pointless options. I don't want to be alone. I don't want to be with others. I don't want to think of the future. I'm mortified by the past. Everything is too loud. Everything is too bright. My head hurts. I'm exhausted. I'm hateful. And underneath this swirling mess of thoughts, when my mind is clear enough to perceive it, there's a numb and throbbing sadness.
Yeah.
Just after we've talked about the fun and the joy and what have you, tell me about that absolute, I don't know if it's the darkest darkness, but it's darkness.
Yeah, so one of the things that I'm glad I did with the book, and I did intend to do, largely because I was, like I said, I was reading really cool works by people like Emily Pyne and Sinead Leeson who went a bit deeper. And I love funniness and I love humour and I love reading funny stuff. And I think funniness doesn't mean things can't be serious. So I knew I wanted to write kind of some funny stories, but I also kind of wanted to reflect some of the real things in my life. And one of the real things is kind of recurring issues with my mental health. And part of why I wanted to write that essay was because a friend or a kind of colleague and friend once said to me, oh, you're such a calm person. Mm. And I realized I was kind of presenting as very calm. And I'm very aware that there's lots of issues. A lot of us have issues with kind of mental health. And I didn't want to keep presenting. I can present as calm. I present quite calm now. But I did want to kind of, I wanted people to know about this side of my life, because I kind of want these essays to either entertain or be helpful in some way. And
can I ask you, if I was a friend of yours, how would I know that you drifted into the shade?
My friends would know. Like, I'm quite an open person, but because I haven't written about myself, a lot of people wouldn't. Like, my friends and my wife and
And how could family. They tell? What do you do or say? Or
I'd just probably be really distracted. So I get issues with anxiety and depression every now and again, and I will still get on with things. Like, I think a lot of people I now know can relate to this. Like, mine is a form of depression where I just stop enjoying things. And I will still manage to tick the boxes of my job and tick the boxes of the things I'm meant to do.
A functioning depression.
I'm functioning, but I'll look distracted and I won't be completely there. And then I feel guilty because I'm not completely there for people. And I worry that I'm not picking up on things I should pick up on in other people's lives, because I become slightly self-obsessive monitoring my own condition.
Yeah.
Which, you know, on the flip side of that, being able to do that when I'm not depressed is useful for a book like this, you know.
How do you confront it? Is it, do you see a psychiatrist or a therapist, or do you medicate, or is it all of the above?
I have gone to therapy and found it really useful. And I find that for me, generally, I need to have a kind of balanced life. You know, like, sure. I need to have my walks and reading and time with people and time alone, time off the internet, because I find a lot of that kind of modern technology just really kind of, we talked about, it's like bees just buzzing, and it just kind of adds to a general
noise.
Sense of distraction.
Yeah, noise.
Yeah.
White noise often and ugly noise often.
And it doesn't give you the calmness and peace you need, which you can kind of get from, you know, from a walk or from reading a paper book,
you know,
or talking to a friend. Sure. Whereas you can get dragged into kind of trawling through Twitter for hours nowadays. And I think, you know, in the pandemic, that's a danger for people because it just stirs up the anxiety they might already have. And sometimes it's just better to unplug.
You write beautifully about your family, your siblings and your mum and dad, like I say. And then you got married, obviously. You're 45, I think. Yeah. Now, so roughly same age as myself, thereabouts. And then you write, you kind of drop a bomb that says, couldn't have kids, didn't want to get into IVF and adoption, and that's where I am. And yet you've all these nieces and nephews who you clearly adore and hanging out with and doing all the things. I don't recall the last time I've met a man who talks about this. So it's kind of it was refreshing for me to see that. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I wanted to write about that because, you know, I think people are quite sensitive on this issue, but some people aren't. So some people, people make assumptions that everyone has the same life, and they make assumptions that, you know, either everyone wants kids or everyone can have kids, or that everyone isn't, like, there's a lot of people who are conflicted about having kids. And the fact that I think I wrote that essay, I started writing that essay a couple of years ago, and again, it was another essay I had to come back to when I felt better about things. Mm. And I had a dream. It was at a time when I was kind of a bit hungry for kids. I thought I really wanted it. And I had a dream about, like, it's actually kind of funny. I had a dream about a post-apocalyptic landscape in which all of my family had disappeared except one of my nephews, and I was minding him. And it was a lovely dream. I woke up going, that was a really nice dream. And it kind of got me thinking about kids and wanting kids and not having kids, and the fact that you hit a certain point in your life. And for all of my talk about, like, you know, being in bands and doing kind of countercultural things when I was younger, I was largely in parallel with my peers. You know, you kind of go to school, you go to college, you kind of, you might be messing around in a band for a while, but then you get a job and then you get a house. And at a certain point, you realize you're kind of drifting away. Everyone else is doing this other thing, you know, they're having kids. And one of the things I think it does is, like, positively does, is I know from all of my friends and family with kids that they don't have time to think anymore. But it makes me think a lot about the expectations that are on people, that shouldn't be on people. And it makes me think a little bit about, you know, me and Anna are very happy in our lives, and we're structuring. You have to kind of structure when you don't have kids. Something happens when people hit 30s and 40s and they have kids, then their next 20 years are mapped out by kids, you know, which is a wonderful thing in a lot of ways. And in another way, it's kind of, it's just the map. And not being on that map anymore was interesting. And I wanted to write about that because at the time I was more conflicted about it than I am now.
How do you feel about it now?
I think the pandemic has made being stuck in a house with loads of small kids look really difficult. So not that's a glib answer.
But have you made your peace philosophically and intellectually with that now?
And there's a lot in the book that I've made my peace with, which was interesting writing about it.
As a result of the book in some ways?
In some ways. Like, I think it was very useful to me to write that essay about mental health, and it was useful for me to write that essay about kids. Like, my... I know other people who write essays hate the idea that it's of essays, or, you know, writing personal stuff as being in some way cathartic, because they say, no, it should be about the work. But I actually did find it kind of cathartic, and that kind of makes sense. You're putting a narrative on something that might be painful for you, and the act of putting a narrative on it is a little bit of closure on the issue.
Yeah, I would like another volume of them. At some point. I presume you've got built up a catalogue at this stage.
Okay, but let's do your stupider idea or something.
Okay, let's do your stupid idea, Tuberty. Another title entirely. Okay, Cat Hogan was on, so I'm sitting outside work listening to Patrick Frayne. I'll be late, but still, that's a good sign. They're enjoying what you're saying, which is wonderful. The no interest in sport comment, says Therese in Limerick, has struck a chord with me as a parent of a 14-year-old boy in rural Ireland. Zero interest in GAA. He does exactly the same, pretends he likes it, etc. This definitely still goes on. Ultimately, as humans, we just want to fit in. Isn't that funny of all the things? Yeah. Thanks for a wonderful interview with Patrick Frayne. Such a warm, funny, insightful person, says Mary. I could listen to him all day. I can't wait to get my hands on his book. Patrick Frayne has described my personality exactly, says a female listener. And Kerry, so that's what you wanted to do in some ways, from what you're saying, is to connect with people and make a little difference. I heard the phrase from a girlfriend of mine, why do men talk about football? Answer, so they can pretend they're having a conversation.
That's a good one.
Yeah. I often used to say that, you know, fellas in the pub watching the match on the big screen, someone scores a goal and they hug each other. It's an Irish man's way of saying, I love you.
It is. And it is kind of...
Without saying it.
And it's sweet. And like watching it from the outside where I'm still looking at the TV going, what sport is that? It is sweet.
Dee in Dublin says, wow, Patrick Frayne has literally verbalised what I go through regularly with anxiety. I will make it my business to buy his book today. Good morning from Waterford City, says Breda. Really enjoying your interview and I can relate a lot with what Patrick's saying, re-mental health. I have depression and anxiety and finding Patrick's comments very interesting and inspiring. I read and listened to Patrick at the weekend in a hospital post-surgery for a few weeks. I think we're the same age and are both North Kildare blow-ins. Loved it, funny and real, and got to me at times, but mostly just very funny. From Tom in Wexford, currently getting great care in Waterford General. Patrick, thank you for coming in to see us today.
Thank you for having me.
I wish you and Anna every happiness. And I think your book is definitely in one of my books of the year this year, in the top three, because it just did something. I was very moved by it, I have to be honest with you, and I thought it's a slight enough volume, so it's not going to kill people to get through it. You know, some people can be intimidated by books. This is not one of those. But thank you, and well done. I really mean that in a nice way.
I mentioned Anna has a book out called...
This is your wife, Anna Carey, who we've spoken to before, is a wonderful writer.
She's got an excellent book about the lockout for young people called The Boldness of Betty, and my book wouldn't have been possible without Anna's help.
Well, that's a nice thing to say, and actually Anna's written some great books for children and history that are very welcome additions to school libraries around the country. Yeah. And so happy that you mentioned that this morning. Patrick Frayne, what a pleasure. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.